And here is the Vegan's Almanac for today, the 7th of June. The first Sunday of June is National Animal Rights Day. National Animal Rights Day is observed in more than 50 countries around the world for the purpose of giving a voice to all animals and raising awareness for their rights. On this day, special events are held to commemorate the billions of animals who die every year by human hands, educate the public about humanity's treatment of animals and the alternatives to it, and celebrate the progress that is being made towards ending the suffering of animals on Earth. Like Memorial Day and Independence Day for the animals combined, the day will continue to be observed until all animals are free from enslavement and their rights are established and protected by law. The publication of Vegangelical, How Caring for Animals Can Shape Your Faith, by Sarah Withrow King was on this day in 2016. Among the many pressing social concerns that have galvanized evangelical Christians' response, abortion, human trafficking, environmental degradation, and many others, the care of animals has received relatively little attention. Yet as author Sarah Withrow King deftly uncovers in Vegangelical, animal stewardship is a necessary aspect of a holistic ethic of Christian peace and justice. Indeed, care for animal welfare correspondingly strengthens our care for environmental and human flourishing. Practical, restrained in its conclusions, and grounded on a broader theology of Christian compassion, Vegangelical calls readers to a greater attentiveness to one of the primary relationships in God's created order, that between humans and animals. The publication of What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins, by Jonathan Balcombe, was also on this day in 2016. Do fishes think? Do they really have three-second memories? And can they recognize the humans who peer back at them from above the surface of the water? In What a Fish Knows, the myth-busting ethologist Jonathan Balcombe addresses these questions and more, taking us under the sea, through streams and estuaries, and to the other side of the aquarium glass, to reveal the surprising capabilities of fishes. Although there are more than 30,000 species of fish, more than all mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians combined, we rarely consider how individual fishes think, feel, and behave. Balcombe upends our assumptions about fishes, portraying them not as unfeeling, dead-eyed feeding machines, but as sentient, aware, social, and even Machiavellian, in other words, much like us. What a Fish Knows draws on the latest science to present a fresh look at these remarkable creatures and all their breathtaking diversity and beauty. Fishes conduct elaborate courtship rituals and develop lifelong bonds with shoal mates. They also plan, hunt cooperatively, use tools, curry favor, deceive one another, and punish wrongdoers. What a Fish Knows will forever change how we see our aquatic cousins. The publication of Vegan Art, a book of visual protest, edited by Tommy Kane, was on this day in 2022. In this volume, the celebrated American illustrator Tommy Kane brings together a collection of contemporary vegan artists whose works confront our conflicted relationship with animals. With diverse contributions, Vegan Art combines a passion for art as a language for the rebellion against animal abuse and exploitation, with the belief that art should be a mechanism for social change. The iconography of this book is purposefully graphic and controversial. From utopian depictions of a world that vegans are fighting for, to dark dystopian impressions and brutal, bloody mutilations of non-human animals in industrial agriculture, the project tests the potential of our humanity and asks for equality for all species. Including violent imagery and references to major food corporations such as McDonald's, the project is unflinching in its advocacy of veganism and animal rights. Vegan art engenders the belief that art has the power to move people to be informed consumers. And here's a poem for today, Fish, by Brian Turner. The child asks me, "Is it wet inside a fish?" And I say, "No." And he says, "Then what is it?" And I say, It's red and pink and cool as a tomb in the morning. And he says, "How do you know except when she's dead?" Fish by Brian Turner. This has been the Vegan's Almanac with a reminder that we need to take a fresh look at animals. Welcome to Animalia Hour, a full hour of news and stories related to non-human animals, as well as the joyful and healthful benefits of plant-based eating. I am your host, Sarah Hale. Thank you for being here. And to start out Animalia Hour today, let's go local. We're going to read an article from Montana Free Press. It was published May 6th of 2026. The title is, "Are Fort Peck Reservoir Fish Too Polluted to Eat?" It depends on who you ask. The debate behind the PFAS forever chemicals found in game fish in the Missouri, Yellowstone, and East Gallatin Rivers. This is written by Amanda Eggert. Montanans who regularly eat fish harvested from some of the state's most popular angling destinations may want to reconsider their diet. State agencies are directing people to limit their consumption of certain fish species found in the state's rivers and reservoirs contaminated with PFAS, a class of chemicals linked to cancers and other serious health risks. On April 23rd, a trio of state agencies updated the Montana Sport Fish Consumption Guidelines with new advisories that take into account concentrations of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, which have been dubbed forever chemicals due to their persistence in the environment. According to those guidelines, women and children should avoid eating large walleye and northern pike from Fort Peck Reservoir, as well as brown trout from the section of Prickly Pear Creek downstream of the now shuttered Azarco lead smelter in East Helena. On a handful of other rivers and reservoirs, such as the East Gallatin River, Nelson Reservoir, and Yellowstone River, the guidelines advise limiting consumption of other fish species ranging from channel catfish to mountain whitefish and smallmouth bass. The Montana Department of Environmental Quality did not make any of that immediately clear in its press release. Instead, it wrote that PFAS are considered emerging contaminants of concern and highlighted PFAS-associated health risks alongside the dietary advantages of eating fish. While it is important to be aware that eating fish caught in Montana may expose individuals to low levels of PFAS in some water bodies, eating a moderate amount of a variety of fish can provide significant health benefits for many people, the agency wrote. The calculations that underpin the state's recommendations have come under scrutiny following a years-long investigation by Montana PBS. According to a 30-minute documentary reported and produced by the station's Anna Rao, Governor Greg Gianforte intercepted the monitoring report, delaying updates to the consumption advisory designed to help Montanans understand where game fish are safe to eat, where they should be consumed sparingly, and where there's too contaminant-laden to eat at all. According to Rao's reporting, DEQ and other state agencies prepared to implement a more stringent standard for fish consumption, only to change course when faced with a number of do-not-consume advisories the stricter standard would have generated for popular fishing destinations like Fort Peck Reservoir, the lower Yellowstone River, and the middle section of the Missouri River. Just hours before the documentary's broadcast on April 23rd, The state released complicated guidance that left Montanans wondering if their local waters are too contaminated with forever chemicals to eat their catch. The documentary has anglers like Russ Earl, a Havre resident, concerned. Earl doesn't plan to eat what he catches when he fishes Fort Peck Reservoir and upstream stretches of the Missouri for catfish, bass, sturgeon, walleye, and salmon later this year. Quote, "What bothers me the most is the apparent possible delay and semi-cover-up of the original report," he wrote in a message to MTFP. "Unfortunately, I think this is the tip of the iceberg, and more studies will find more and more PFAS through our food chain." Earl is not alone in trying to make sense of the state's response to its own data. To better understand how the Montana Interagency Fish Consumption Advisory Group reached its guidance and the diet shift that frequent fish consumers should contemplate, Montana Free Press spoke with PFAS experts and state and local regulators, and this is what we found. The PFAS fish connection. PFAS are a class of chemicals that manufacturing companies have long prized for their lubricant properties and their ability to resist grease and stains. There are so many of them, up to 14,000 by some counts, that federal agencies have struggled to regulate the chemicals. PFAS are frequently present in nonstick cookware, water-resistant outdoor apparel, personal care products, food and beverage packaging, pesticides, the biosolids produced by wastewater treatment plants, and a variety of industrial applications, including firefighting foam. PFAS received the Forever Chemicals moniker because they don't break down the way other chemicals do. They're also highly mobile and widespread. According to DEQ, PFAS have been detected in the blood of people and animals around the world. That's a problem because PFAS pose serious health threats. According to Julia Warshawski, an environmental health professor at Northwestern University and member of the PFAS Project Lab, a growing body of research has demonstrated the link between PFAS exposure and low birth weights, preterm births, high cholesterol, and diminished immune response. PFAS exposure is also associated with testicular and kidney cancer. Researchers pay attention to the accumulation of PFAS in fish, freshwater fish in particular, because fish living in PFAS-contaminated waters are what's called a bioaccumulator. When they get into an animal's body, they distribute to the fat tissue, and then because that gets concentrated and stuck in the fat tissue, the next higher up animal on the food chain that eats the smaller one will further and further concentrate that PFAS, Warshawski said, pointing to fatty, predatory freshwater fish as particularly worrisome bioaccumulators. Warshawski added that the most important PFAS exposure pathways, based on what we currently know, are water and diet. When it comes to fish, she said, there are no overarching federal regulations the way there are with PFAS in drinking water, for example. Instead, states have developed their own standards that attempt to weigh the PFAS ingestion risks against the health benefits of eating fish, which are a source of lean protein, healthy fats, and essential vitamins and minerals. The result is a patchwork of recommendations. Some states, such as New Jersey and Michigan, have opted for stricter frameworks. Some have adopted looser regulations, and some haven't produced any guidance at all. Montana falls somewhere in the middle. Montana's Forever Chemical Guidance. In Montana, the conversation surrounding PFAS accumulation in fish dates back to 2020, when the state adopted the Montana PFAS Action Plan. That document was designed to reduce or eliminate human health and environmental risks posed by PFAS. It directed the state to identify sources and exposure pathways, to sample fish in PFAS-polluted water bodies, and to develop fish consumption advisories. The bulk of Montana's monitoring occurred in 2023 when DEQ partnered with Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the Department of Public Health and Human Services to collect samples of common game fish at 14 sites located along 9 water bodies where PFAS is a known concern. Lab results found at least one type of PFAS was present in 78% of the samples submitted. Of the 40 PFAS the lab tested for, the type that appeared most frequently was PFOS, a chemical commonly found in firefighting foams used at airports and military bases. 39 of the 50 fish samples sent to the lab for analysis contained PFOS. After the concentrations came back, state employees working on the report debated how to interpret the results in order to develop updated fish consumption guidance. Materials submitted to PBS in a public records request reviewed by MTFP show that DEQ contemplating using two different calculations to translate fish tissue concentrations into the fish consumption advisories, which are designed to help ensure that the fish you catch can be a safe part of your diet. One standard, based on guidance provided to DEQ by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in 2024, would have led to sweeping fish consumption advisories. According to a June 2024 email from DEQ's toxicologist and included in the PBS FOIA request, the EPA's formula would have resulted in a different conclusion. We find that the PFOS concentrations found in sampled fish end up corresponding to an avoid all consumption advisory in all water bodies where PFAS is detected, including some very popular fishing destinations, DEQ toxicologist Don Nelson wrote in the email. Records show that had the state used the EPA standard for safe levels of PFOS, one of the most prevalent forever chemicals, popular game fish like walleye, brown trout, rainbows, and smallmouth bass would have been subjected to an avoid advisory in certain waterways. Instead of using that standard, the state decided to use a looser standard recommended by a different federal agency, the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. That standard didn't result in any broad do not consume advisories. DEQ defended the use of the looser standard in an email to MTFP, writing that 20 states have used it or something very similar to it. Spokesperson Madison McGeffers added that the federal government has found that PFOS levels in fish tissue are trending lower across the U.S. Asked to respond to allegations that his office interfered with the release of the PFAS fish tissue report, a spokesperson from Gianforte's office focused on the April 2026 report, the governor was not involved in the decision as the timing of the release of the report was related to the fact that members of Interagency Fish Consumption Advisory Group reached consensus on using the health guidance value from Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry in late 2025, the spokesperson wrote. Rao with Montana PBS argues that Gianforte is splitting hairs in his response by focusing on the report that came out last month, not the draft report that preceded it. As evidence to support her position, she points to a February 14, 2025 email in which a DEQ employee directs her colleague not to reach out to stakeholders about the release of the draft report because, quote, the governor's office may not want us to release the draft report. Farshovsky, the PFAS researcher, said Montana is not unique in wrestling with the political implications of PFAS regulation, particularly in the face of burgeoning data center development. The semiconductors that are integral to data center operations and the coolant to keep them from overheating via closed-loop cooling systems are common sources of PFAS, according to Warshawski. It shouldn't be polarizing to say that we need policies that protect public health. But unfortunately, it kind of is, she said. It's not necessarily that it's a political issue for regular people, but it has become a political issue in these decision-making contexts where you have industries lobbying lawmakers. For her part, Rouse said, the state's abrupt course change paired with the concentrations present in Missouri River and Fort Peck Reservoir fish have crystallized her own views on the issue. I wouldn't in a million years feed my kid a fish out of Fort Peck right now, she's told MTFP. I just wouldn't, for safety's sake. So just to review, many environmental toxins and chemicals are lipophilic, fat-soluble. Because they cannot be easily excreted, they bioaccumulate in the food chain. This means fat-rich animal products often carry a higher, more concentrated load of these persistent pollutants than plant foods. As you move up the food chain, animals consume other organisms. Toxins from the environment, such as dioxins, PCBs, and heavy metals, are retained and stored in the body's fat tissues rather than broken down. Many of the most concerning pollutants like DDT, which was banned decades ago, but persists in the environment, are uniquely drawn to animal fats. According to the US EPA, more than 90% of typical human exposure to dioxins occurs through the intake of animal fats, meat, and dairy products. But plant-based foods, plants are at the bottom of the food chain, meaning they avoid the compounding effects of biomagnification. While plants are exposed to modern agricultural sprays, many water-soluble pesticides are washed, metabolized, or excreted, whereas fat-soluble chemicals are stored and concentrated in livestock tissue. Another reason to avoid eating animals and eat plants instead. And another story of local interest was published recently in Field and Stream, titled Early Algal Blooms Choke Prize Trout Streams in Southwest Montana. Summertime algae blooms are showing up in some of Montana's best rivers much earlier than expected. This article was written by Katie Hill. When Brian Wheeler set out to install water quality monitoring equipment in the Big Hole River near Twin Bridges, Montana, on June 28th, he encountered an unexpected sight. In many parts of the river, the water had begun to turn the putrid shade of green characteristic of algal blooms. Algal blooms are caused by a specific set of conditions that waters in the West are increasingly prone to. When hot water temperatures combine with high amounts of nitrogen and phosphorus, two nutrients that frequently enter surface waters through agricultural runoff, the result is a blossoming cloud of algae spreading through the water. As that bloom grows, it consumes much of the water's dissolved oxygen content in the process, resulting in hypoxia and lots of dead fish. Wheeler was less alarmed about what he saw and more concerned with when he saw it. These blooms usually don't show up in the rivers of southwest Montana, a trout angler's paradise and a cornerstone in the state's $900 million per year fishing industry, for another month or so. But they came so early this year that they even preceded some of Wheeler's dissolved oxygen data collection, which nonprofit trout and water conservation organization Save Wild Trout, or SWT, has conducted in the Jefferson River Basin for years. Wheeler is on the advisory board of SWT, based in western Montana. He was the executive director of the Big Hole River Foundation, which recently joined forces with SWT to expand both organizations' capacity for data collection and water quality advocacy. SWT collaborates with the Montana Department of Environmental Quality and Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks to gather environmental data that fills knowledge gaps and supports the state's wildlife, fisheries, and habitat management. This work is especially important in Beaverhead County. It's the largest county in the state in terms of square mileage. It also regularly ranks as the highest livestock and forage-producing county in the state, which requires an immense amount of irrigation. And depending on who you ask, it's home to some of the best fly fishing in the West writ large. All these claims to fame, plus the steady march of climate change, put a lot of additional stress on the county's water resources, Wheeler explains. Everything's been early this year, Wheeler said. June was really behaving like July. We've had several drought years in a row, and soil moisture levels are so low that even this year's reasonable snowpack isn't really getting all the way back to the rivers. MDEQ identifies a series of beneficial uses that all surface waters in the state are mandated to support. They include irrigation, drinking water, bathing and recreation, industrial use, and the support of aquatic life. But we're not fully supporting aquatic life, Wheeler said. We don't even need our own data to show that. Fish counts show that. Bug data shows that. Aquatic invertebrate communities are shifting, and we're seeing fewer mayflies, stoneflies, and caddisflies. Anglers are noticing that these hatches aren't what they were 20 years ago. Ranchers are feeling it too. Irrigation is tricky because everyone has a water right, and soil moisture levels are so poor, so it's sort of a death by a thousand cuts situation. Wheeler and SWT sent out a press release on July 1st warning the conservation community of these early algal blooms, which Wheeler also found in the Jefferson and Boulder rivers after covering 500 miles in one weekend of field work. SWT will continue their monitoring efforts throughout the summer. They will also continue sharing their data with MDEQ, which will start their own monitoring work in the weeks ahead. Wheeler also encouraged anglers and recreators to use MFWP's sick and dead fish reporting tool as needed. Ultimately, SWT's wider goal is to emphasize the extreme importance of improved data collection to the future of healthy and thriving aquatic ecosystems across the state and the region. Wheeler said, water quality, bugs, fish, the fishing industry, irrigators, livestock, and residents all depend on that future common ground that's easy to overlook when playing tug of war with a resource as limited and precious as water. Certainly, climate change is having a noticeable impact, regardless of whether you're willing to say those words or not. He said, we've tried the fishermen versus ranchers thing. It's been a failure. The headbutting just keeps good collaborative work from getting done. Whether you're a fishing guide or an irrigator, we're all neighbors. And right now, everybody's taking the hit. And just to review, we see algal blooms are a direct consequence of industrialized animal agriculture. The billions of farmed animals generate massive amounts of manure. When this waste and the synthetic fertilizers used to grow livestock feed run off into waterways, they cause severe nutrient pollution. Animal waste and feed crop fertilizers are extremely high in nitrogen and phosphorus. These nutrients wash into rivers, lakes, and coastal oceans, acting as liquid fertilizer that causes algae to multiply rapidly. As these algae die and decompose, they consume the oxygen in the water, resulting in aquatic dead zones where fish and marine life cannot survive. We as vegans argue that algal blooms are not an unavoidable natural phenomenon, but rather the result of a fundamentally inefficient, high-density food system. Because livestock require vast amounts of feed, over 80% of agricultural land is used for animal feed. This necessitates heavy fertilizer use, which further exacerbates runoff problems. Vegans emphasize that the environmental damage caused by animal agriculture inherently contradicts ethical treatment of wildlife, as these blooms lead directly to massive fish die-offs and damaged aquatic ecosystems. The solution, eliminating or sharply reducing animal products in the global diet, would drastically reduce the demand for synthetic fertilizers and the sheer volume of animal manure, allowing waterways to heal. Removing farmed animals from the food system would free up immense tracts of arable land, dramatically lowering agricultural runoff and the subsequent risk of harmful algal blooms. And here's an interesting article titled "Consuming Creation: The Ecological Toll of Animal Agriculture." This appeared in the Jesuit Post, written by Daniel Mascarenhas. After screening the documentary "Eating Our Way to Extinction" at my parish, one of the attendees acknowledged his unawareness about the devastating environmental impact of meat. One might imagine that someone attending this documentary might already have been aware of the significant contribution of meat production to the environmental crisis. The fact that even meat eaters who are sympathetic to environmental issues do not know the impact of their own diets underscores the severity of the problem of ignorance in this pressing issue. Ignorance of our contribution is a primary cause of our apathy towards the ecological crisis. The best way to address what Pope Francis calls the globalization of indifference is to raise awareness about the problem. When people ask me why I am vegan, I reply, "If you knew what I knew, you would be vegan as well." Treating the problems associated with meat production as out of sight, out of mind is neither a sustainable nor a Christian way of proceeding in the face of grave injustice. Even those aware of the large carbon footprint of meat may not appreciate its magnitude or its impacts on water quality and land use. To counter this globalization of indifference, this article will shine light on the ignored ecological cost of animal-based food. Visitors to Capitol Reef National Park in Utah, famous for its sandstone rock formations, cannot swim in the river because of water contamination by farmed animals upstream of the park. Farmed animals are packed together in much higher concentrations than wild animals, leading to water contamination from insufficient dilution. Additionally, runoff of fertilizers used to grow feed for animals results in nitrate contamination, which stimulates toxic algae bloom and dead zones in water bodies such as lakes, rivers, and coastal seas. Besides contamination, the major issue of animal agriculture is water consumption from increasingly depleted rivers and aquifers. A report in the New York Times noted that more than half of the water from the Colorado River, a once mighty river that now no longer reaches the ocean, is used to feed animals. The crops grown for direct human consumption use less than a quarter of the water that livestock feed uses. For instance, it takes 38 gallons of water to produce 1/4-pound beef patty. In comparison, producing the same amount of protein through tofu needs about 5 gallons of water. Even much maligned almond milk uses less water than dairy milk. Furthermore, production of animal-based foods requires large tracts of land. Because we cannot create more land, we must convert forests and grasslands to farms. Over 90% of the deforestation in the Amazon rainforest is driven by the need to grow feed for farmed animals. Some sources suggest that the carbon dioxide released by converting wild landscapes into farms and pastures is already the most damaging source of agricultural carbon emissions, worse than methane from cow burps. Corn and soy farms currently occupy land that could be returned to their native forests and grassland ecosystems. For instance, Denmark plans to plant 1 billion trees to convert 10% of farmland into forests and natural habitats over the next two decades. Plant-based diets need a fraction of the land to provide the same amount of calories and protein for human consumption. If the world adopted a plant-based diet, we would slash global agricultural land use from 4 to 1 billion hectares. This is because most of our agricultural land is used to grow crops or grazing for animals. Imagine returning 3 billion hectares back to forest and grasslands that will serve as giant carbon-soaking lungs for our planet. That's four times the size of the contiguous U.S. Lest we think that humane, free-range animal farming might be the silver bullet, let's remember that Earth's land area is limited. We could do some math to quantify our land capacity for free-range animals. Excluding Alaska, the U.S. has about 3 million square miles of land, leaving out 33%, 5% for urban use, and 27% for current forest cover. We are left with 2 million square miles of land. Every year, Americans consume 8 billion chickens, 120 million pigs, 35 million cows, and 270 million turkeys. If we imagine using all that land to raise animals and for nothing else, every square mile of land would need to provide free-range forage for 4,000 chickens, 60 pigs, 18 cows, and 135 turkeys, excluding dairy cows and egg-laying chickens. Even if we used every available square mile of America, we would not be able to sustain our current rate of meat consumption without factory farming. Controversially, free-range farms on a large scale may be worse for the environment than factory farms. Michael Grunewald wrote in the New York Times, "Old McDonald's-style farms where soil is nurtured with love and animals have names rather than numbers may sound environmentally friendly, but their artisanal grains and grass-fed beef are worse for nature than chemical-drenched corn and feedlot-fattened beef because they require much more land for each calorie they produce." Grunewald uses this argument to justify industrial agriculture because he believes that people will not reduce meat consumption. Such a cynical view of humanity, which sees us as incapable of great change, is not worthy of Christians. Discipleship of Christ is about turning away from our sinful ways and walking the way of love, kindness, and compassion, even when it is not the most convenient thing to do. If we cannot have free-range meat, we ought to abstain rather than settle for the cruel factory-farmed meat. The carbon footprint of meat is relatively well known among the general population. However, the magnitude of that footprint ought to give us pause. In a previous essay, I had noted that 25% of our total carbon footprint comes from the meat and dairy in our diet. If Americans shifted to a plant-based diet, we would slash our nation's carbon emissions by a quarter, thereby gaining precious time to decarbonize the electric grid and improve the efficiency of our transportation system. All that hand-wringing and mournful sighing regarding climate change at the COP summits and environmental advocacy gatherings are disconnected from reality when we ignore the cow in the room, the consumption of animal-based foods. Given the outsized impact of animal agriculture on climate change, one may not call oneself a climate activist while continuing to consume animal-based foods unabated. Knowledge of the environmental impacts of animal-based diets ought to invoke in us a desire for change. However, change for the good is not inevitable when the status quo has a vice-like grip on our habits. Martin Luther King Jr. once wrote, "We must come to see that human progress never rolls in on wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of people willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. Things will not improve if we do not work at improving them." In the same essay, King noted that if today's church does not recapture the sacrificial spirit of the early church, It will lose its authenticity, forfeit the loyalty of millions, and be dismissed as an irrelevant social club with no meaning for the 20th century. The Christian life is about sacrificing the comfort of the status quo for the sake of discipleship of Christ, which includes care for God's creation. Perhaps if you don't know how to cook plant-based food, you could begin by eating plant-based meals at restaurants. You could learn one plant-based recipe a month that you could use twice a month. In a year, you will have 12 plant-based recipes that will serve you 24 days a month. It's never too late to learn to cook. Personally, I took cooking seriously only after I turned vegan in my early 30s because I had to sustain myself in meat and dairy heavy Jesuit communities. I had to live in the reality of a vegan lifestyle if I were to continue advocating for it. Happily, I found that vegan food is easy to cook, nutritious, delicious, and affordable. Fortunately, meat, dairy, and eggs do not have to be the default main dishes. It was made so by the marketing genius of Big Ag and the generous subsidies they wrangled from the government. Happily, things are beginning to change. Recently, an advisory committee to the Agriculture Department proposed changes to U.S. dietary guidelines by encouraging people to eat more beans and lentils and less red meat. Ida B. Wells, an early leader in the civil rights movement, sagely noted that the way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them. Now we know the wrongs we inflict on the environment through our continued consumption of animal-based foods. Now that we know, let us commit to abstaining from participation in unnecessary and wanton ecological destruction through consumption of animal-based food. To show our care for God's creation, a plant-based diet can provide an easy, healthy, compassionate, and cost-efficient way forward. And from Sentient Media, 10 million tons of manure in California are unaccounted for, new report shows. Stanford researchers found serious loopholes in factory farm regulation, and it's not just in California. Factory farms in California routinely avoid pollution regulations intended to protect the state's water, finds a new white paper out of Stanford. 10 million tons of animal manure in the Golden State are unaccounted for, the report finds, thanks to a combination of non-compliance, non-enforcement, and opaque disclosure rules. It is not known from public information where the manure went, says Zoe Robertson, JD candidate at Stanford Law and an author of the white paper, but some may well have ended up directly or indirectly in lakes, streams, and other public waters. Lax regulation of factory farm pollution in the United States isn't unique to California. Factory farms, also known as concentrated animal feeding operations or CAFOs, produce enormous amounts of pollution, yet federal laws to reduce it are limited in scope and riddled with loopholes. Even in states with ostensibly stricter regulatory regimes, like California, CAFO pollution frequently goes unchecked and unregulated. California has some of the most factory farms in the country, out of all the states, but it's really not part of our primary identity, Louis Bernier, lead researcher at the Factory Farm Watch Project, tells Sentient. But it most definitely is an agricultural state, and the ways in which California's factory farms have dodged or in some cases simply decided not to comply with pollution regulations is a discouraging but informative illustration of how factory farms around the country do the same. Shining a light on these regulatory lapses also offers clues as to how lawmakers, state agencies, and farm operators can do better in the future and minimize the destructive impact of their facilities. California CAFOs at a glance. California has more factory farms than all but five other U.S. states, according to the Environmental Protection Agency. It's one of the top five cattle-holding states and top 15 egg-producing states in the country, according to the USDA. Dairy farms are an especially big business in the Golden State. There are more dairy cows and farms in California than anywhere else in the United States, which makes it the top milk-producing state in the country as well. There's no doubt that factory farms have a serious presence in California, but the closer you look, the fuzzier the picture gets. For instance, the EPA maintains that there are a total of 1,053 CAFOs in California. But the EPA is not transparent at all about how they came to that number. And they don't have a publicly released list of these 1,000-something farms, Bernier says. Why CAFO regulations matter. American livestock produce around 941 billion pounds of manure every year, and it has to go somewhere. Much of it is applied to fields as fertilizer, which can allow the nitrogen in the manure to leach into the groundwater and end up in lakes, rivers, streams, groundwater, and wetlands. According to the National Resources Defense Council, agriculture is the leading source of pollution in streams and rivers in the U.S. and the second leading source in wetlands. Agricultural pollution from manure contains forms of nitrogen and phosphorus, too much of which can contaminate drinking water, cause harmful algal blooms, and harm ecosystems. It can also contain antimicrobial-resistant bacteria that can threaten human lives. For these reasons, efforts to rein in factory farm pollution often focus on manure management. What's keeping California farms from polluting the water? At the federal level, the Clean Water Act governs water pollution in the United States. It requires certain facilities that dump pollution directly into waters of the U.S. to obtain a discharge permit, which places some limits on the amount of pollution allowed. But federal law allows states to establish their own standards and distribute permits, so long as their standards are as strict or more so than the Clean Water Act. But less than one-third of all factory farms in the United States actually have a pollution discharge permit, since a number of loopholes allow them to avoid these regulations altogether. Even farms that do have permits are often able to evade their requirements without consequence. California has opted to distribute discharge permits and enforce the Clean Water Act's discharge regulations at the state level, which is done by the State Water Resources Control Board. This board oversees 9 regional water boards. They develop the permit rules and enforce discharge regulations for their regions of the state, and all too often, they don't do a very good job at either. Regulatory holes in California animal agriculture. As a major dairy state with several levels of regulation, California is a case study of the ways in which farms can slip through the regulatory cracks, even in states with ostensibly high levels of CAFO regulation. The water boards do not impose sufficient reporting requirements on factory farms, Robertson tells Sentient. Because of this, it's actually difficult to evaluate the full impacts of industrial animal agriculture on state water quality, she says. Even though the reporting requirements are minimal, she says, she sees what she calls an underwhelming level of compliance on the part of factory farms. Each of the 9 regional water boards in California have different standards and enforcement mechanisms for the facilities in their jurisdiction. The Stanford White Paper looked at the 5 regions with the most factory farms, covering 99% of the state's factory farms, in an attempt to determine how well regulated they actually were. The answer was not very. Sometimes farms didn't follow the rules. Other times they did follow the rules, but the rules were dubious or questionably lax. And other times they broke the rules and simply weren't penalized for it. California farms frequently underreport the amount of manure their animals produce, sometimes reporting amounts that are biologically impossible, the study found. One farm in the Colorado River Basin reported producing less than 1% as much manure as expected, given the number of cows it houses, while another in Santa Ana said that it produced no manure at all, despite housing 570 dairy cows. When farms do report their manure, each regional board uses a different formula to estimate how much manure a single cow is expected to produce. These formulas aren't public, and some of them don't square with federal USDA estimates. The regional water boards in Santa Ana and the Colorado River Basin, for instance, estimate that an adult dairy cow produces 4.1 tons of manure every year, a number just one-fifth of the USDA's official estimates. Transparency and compliance is also lacking around where manure goes. Manure manifesting is a common practice on farms in the United States, and California is no exception. Manifesting is when large factory farms transfer some or all of their manure to farms that aren't subject to manure disposal regulations. In some cases, the secondary farm is owned by the factory farm itself. Three of California's regions covered in the report don't require farms to reveal where they're sending their manure, and even farms in two regions that do often fail to comply with this requirement. One farm located in the Central Valley, which does have such a requirement, acknowledged that it manifested 1,380 tons of manure in 2023, but didn't say where. Emissions of this sort are common, Stanford's researchers found. Then there's wastewater. On farms, this typically refers to water that's used to wash animals and clean their facilities. It's not realistically possible to run an animal farm without producing some amount of wastewater, which often contains the same pollutants as the animal's manure and can contaminate nearby waterways if it's not disposed of properly. Yet three of the five regions the study examined don't require farms to report how much wastewater they create. And in the two regions that do have such a requirement, factory farms frequently underreport it. In 2024, for instance, 14% of dairy farms that the study analyzed reported producing no wastewater at all, even though those farms had an average herd size of 313 cows. Finally, the researchers sought to identify whether farms faced any consequences when violating these regulations. But even answering this question was difficult, Robertson says, because the regulations seem to not specify whether the water boards have to record enforcement actions or violations. The water board does have authority to issue civil fines or have hearings, but we didn't see evidence of those things being done, Robertson says. There is certainly no public-facing record of them, she says. Nevertheless, there was some evidence that when farms violate their permitting regulations, they don't always face consequences. Two of the five regional boards logged zero violations by any of their farms in the last 5 years, even though Robertson and her colleagues found, in her words, pretty strong evidence in the farms' annual reports that some of them have violated regulations in 2023 and 2024. How to tighten up regulations on California farms? Stanford researchers didn't stop at identifying the lapses in factory farm regulation. They also proposed some concrete solutions for cutting down on them in the future. We tried to introduce solutions that are authorized by the law and also relatively feasible, says Robertson. First, Robertson and her co-authors recommend that all farms be required to submit annual data on three key aspects of their operations: wastewater, the nutrient content of their manure, and the quality of groundwater at nearby wells. The reporting requirements should be standardized across all nine water boards, they say, instead of the current patchwork of different rules for different regions. Furthermore, farms should be required to submit the laboratory analysis and manure tracking paperwork to back up their annual reports, Robertson says. Statewide, the California Code of Regulations does mandate that factory farms' annual reports include one of these metrics, their average daily volume of facility wastewater, Robertson says. But it seems like this regulatory requirement did not trickle down to all of the regional water boards, she says, because three of the five regional boards and her team examined do not include this on the discharge permits that they issue to farms. And as a result, farms do not report it. Second, the paper's authors argue for stricter rules on manure reporting. Farms don't actually measure all of the manure their animals create. Rather, they use a formula to estimate their annual manure prediction based on how many animals they have, how old the animals are, what they're being used for, and other factors. This formula is called a manure conversion factor. The bottom line. Ultimately, the ways in which California CAFOs skate past regulations is a microcosm of the country's generally lax attitude toward factory farm regulation. In addition to all of the loopholes mentioned above, factory farms in the United States are also excluded from federal animal welfare laws, as well as laws that require other facilities to report accidental spillage of hazardous waste. They're not required to track or report their greenhouse gas emissions, and labor violations at CAFOs are common and widespread. The Stanford paper illustrates how California's farms dodge regulations, and Robertson hopes state regulators will take its findings into account as they continue to update and refine their policies. The water boards are actually in the midst of a process to reform the requirements on dairies. Robertson says, "I'm hoping that the water boards will take these suggestions into account." We hope you enjoyed today's installment of Animalia Hour with me, Sarah Hale. We'll be back next week with more news and stories. Wishing you a gorgeous day. Bye.